This podcast is supported by the growing community of artists and art lovers through the Gently Does It Patreon page. Go to patreon.com/ John Dalton Gently Does It to join the conversation. I'm very happy to be talking to Mary Jane Ansell today in Shropshire in the UK. Mary Jane is an artist. She paints pristine paintings of modern subjects in a style she describes as contemporary romanticism. She's been a finalist in the BP Portrait Award in 2004, 2009, 2010 and 2012. Her work features on the covers of a number of novels and an Adam Ant album cover. She's shown her work in numerous... It's a good start, isn't it? Yeah. She's shown her work in numerous group and solo exhibitions around the world. I'm supposed to end on a down note She's shown her work in numerous group and solo exhibitions around the world. So hello, Mary Jane. It's very nice to be talking to you.
Hello, John. It's great to talk to you. How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. I've had loads of questions for you from social media. No, like I normally say who I'm going to be talking to in advance, and I invite people to let me know if they have any questions they might have. And you've had loads, like you've gone viral.
Oh my goodness, fantastic. Oh gosh,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah, yeah. Most of them are serious, but let's start off with a not-so-serious one. This one's from artist Sean Chambers in Maine, and he wants to know if you actually met Adam Ant.
Oh, yes, I did. Oh, yes, I did. Bless him. Yeah, that was fantastic, actually. It's quite a long story, not all of which I can share, unfortunately. I'd love to, perhaps over a pint one day. But yeah, Adam kind of, he spotted the painting and he lived. His studio was just around the corner from the gallery that I had a painting in the window, the painting that's now on the album cover.
Right.
And yeah, when Adam spotted it, he said he used to go walk his dogs at night and spotted it and said, that's my punk girl for the cover of the album. And rang me, got a message via my gallery, and we arranged to meet. And we spent a few hours talking. He's a really fascinating guy. He's got, 'cause he went to Chelsea School of Art in the 60s.
All right.
Studied. I think he studied. Was it under Auerbach? I can't really remember. Actually, he's full of people that he's met. He's one of those people that kind of cross-sected all sorts of different arts disciplines. So he was involved in all sorts of things in a really amazing time in London.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and his flat was just is full of art. He loves to buy artwork. And fantastic old guitars. So he produced a guitar from under the bed at one point, which turned out to be one of Jimi Hendrix's guitars.
Wow.
Everything had a story to it. You can imagine. Everything had a story. It's just, yeah, brilliant, brilliant. Really entertaining few hours. Yeah, and then I got to meet him again because he really sweetly invited me to come along to a video shoot along with Georgie. And Georgie was in there. Actually, we're both in the video, but Georgie was sort of taking a main role in it. So, yeah, I've seen him a few times, and he'd come to a few shows. So, yeah, nice bloke.
Brilliant. Yeah, I watched him in being interviewed for something. I think he was talking about your work, and he's quite came across very intellectual and level, like not crazy. I had that idea that he would be like bouncing off the walls or something, but no, he was very. He's sort of somebody I wouldn't mind having a chat with.
No, you really would. I mean, I think you'd find him equally fascinating. He's got incredibly knowledgeable, as I say, about all sorts of different kind of genres and disciplines and all. And a story about everything. But an incredibly generous guy to use, you know. I mean, he was working. He did that whole tour, kind of self-funded it and self-promoted it. So to take time out of promotion that he was getting for himself to sort of mention me was so generous of him, so sweet.
Yeah,
and that he was like that with he built his band around a number of female musicians as well. So he's got that's something I hadn't sort of really appreciated, was kind of how much support he would give to them as well.
So. Yeah, and he gave big ups to the photographer as well in the same conversation. Something I think that in the same I think in the album cover or sleeves or something like that. He mentioned that as well. So yeah, very generous, great.
Yeah.
Okay, from looking at your paintings and doing a bit of homework before we chatted, I know you like Aang and Boogaroo, for example, but I was curious if there are any artists that you think people might be surprised to know who are also favourites of yours.
Oh, gosh. I don't know. Ewan Ooglow was one of my first influences, I guess, and Lucian Freud, but then that's probably, I mean, from, you know, being at art school in England, you've got that kind of that history of people like Ewan Ooglow and Lucy Freud are going to be big influences. Actually, probably the quite a lot of my earlier influences were actually children's book illustrators like Edmund Delac, you know, even sort of Kate Greenaway or anything that those are the first sort of images that started sparking inspiration in me, you know, to start drawing. So those, I suppose, they become ingrained, don't they? All of those influences.
Right.
I don't think there's any one painter that I would say, you know, above any other.
Yeah.
You know, has influenced me. But
anybody working today that you think people would be surprised that you like?
I don't know about surprise, probably. I'm trying to think of somebody sort of completely different to the way that I work that does kind of.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was curious about. I mean, it's all right if you can't, or if there isn't.
No, not that I'm immediately kind of thinking of. No.
Okay. All right.
I don't think so. I'm not a huge kind of abstract expression fan, or you know, closet kind of. Yeah. No. Not particularly.
All right. Okay. So, how does the idea for a painting start for you?
For quite a number of years, they would start sort of in that semi-waking state of dream state, sort of when I'd read a lot in bed before I fall asleep, and that kind of little glimpse of dream that you're getting as you're falling asleep, that my images would start coming to me then, and then I'd dream some of them. So my first solo show was called Animal Animus, and I was reading Carl Jung, so his archetypes were, that was sort of quite a huge wealth of imagery that I would then disappear off into sleep with. And most of those images literally came fully formed in a dream, and it's quite interesting that the main double portrait in that show, I saw completely in my mind's eye the couple that I wanted for that piece, and I had to sort of go and find them, and it was sort of in the back of my mind, and I was looking for this couple for, you know, for several weeks afterwards until I spotted them, and they were almost identical to the image that I had in my head. And they walked to a restaurant that I was sitting down having a meal with some friends.
Right, so they walked in together.
Yeah they're actually the brother and sister.
Wow.
So and thankfully they were happy to sit for me.
Wow, that's kind of spooky.
I know. There's so many sort of you get that a lot though, don't you? I'm sure a lot of other artists find this, that they're sort of, you get these kind of serendipitous coincidences that sort of come along. To me, they always kind of suggest that you're following the right path. If you like, you're sort of, you are kind of, if you're in that sort of flow and things are moving as in the direction they should be, then those kind of coincidences seem to happen.
Yeah. Okay, so how do you record your ideas when you get them? Like you coming out of dream state, do you write them down, or do you draw them, little sketches, or how do you do that?
Yeah, sometimes I'll write a little sentence, you know, the descriptive sentence about any of the thoughts that are going through through that dream, and a really, really matchstick, you know, pathetically unartistic little matchstick little drawing, and that'll be the template, and then I might work that up slightly, but it'll be such a sort of clear image in my head that I can then go and set that up and shoot that from that image.
Yeah.
So it's just, it's like a, just an aid memoir. Just, make sure that I've got what I need down.
Yeah, it's tricky, isn't it? Because I did that a little bit myself, and you have to be awake enough to record it, to write it down coherently. Like if you had the thing where you wake up the next day and you look at it and what you've written, and you're like, what the hell is that? What was I talking about?
I know. I was just listening to, I think there's always a really, there's a huge sort of correlation between songwriting and coming up with images, I find, because I get to hang out with quite a few songwriters because my other half is one. And,
right.
And we were talking, I think it was Leonard Cohen was talking about the fact that, he would get these melodies, fully formed, and they would come at really inconvenient times. And he said he was driving one day and it was a really, frantic five lanes of traffic. I don't know whether he was in LA or wherever. And this fantastic, perfect melody came to him. And he just said, fuck this, right? If you really want to exist to this melody out of the ether, come back to me when I'm sat down with a pen in my hand, So, and it did. Whatever the muse was that was loitering about, So I don't know which song that was, but it's a great story.
Yeah. Very cooperative.
Yes. Yeah. I think they do. Yeah. Those ideas do come back to you if they mean enough to you, and they kind of they will come back.
Right. I haven't found that to be true personally.
Have you not? What do you do?
No. Cry when that happens.
So,
it does happen sometimes, but I've had it the opposite happen as well, where, I'll be semi-awake and I'll go, this is so fantastic. I'd never forget this. How could I possibly forget this? It's so brilliant. And then I'll drift off and then I'll wake up in the morning and go, oh, shit, I know I had a really good idea last night. Yeah, it's good.
Yeah. Well, how do you know it hasn't come back to you in a different, slightly different form, maybe? Or it yet will, maybe you weren't ready to do it then, Maybe it's an idea that you're still...
I'm in for a tsunami of good ideas then.
Exactly. Yeah, just wait for that day.
That's a lovely positive spin on that. Very good.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I do think that.
That hasn't happened in a while, actually, thinking about it, but it has happened. This is a question from Instagram. It's from artist Megan Welch, and she asks, how early in your process do you know who you'll use for a reference? In other words, does the concept or message of the work come first for you, or do you think of roles, in inverted commas, so to speak, for the people you paint frequently?
Oh, that's interesting, Megan. We just talked about the Animus painting where I saw the characters but didn't know the models in advance. Over the last few years, it's been the other way around, in a sense, because I've been working with a small group of models for the last few years. So they influence my ideas as much as the other way around. So, I know the kinds of characters that they will bring to my ideas, and it shifts, the pitch of the idea. So that means a lot to me. And I think that's why I've been working with people that I've known for quite a few years. But actually, at this point, I'm feeling like I need to break different ground with completely different models. So that will happen too. I mean, that is happening currently. So there's some pieces in the show coming up that are completely, fresh faces to me. So it's exciting because I've always taken on board their my model's characters there. So it's not me just inflicting a persona onto them. They are very much part of it. Yeah.
Is it a bit like the way you've got actors and you kind of think of well-known works of art, works of literature, and if they're going to be made into a film, you kind of think, oh, that person would be great in that role. Is it a bit like that for you when you get an idea?
It kind of is. I mean, I must admit, with Mason, the young blonde model that I've been working with, I think I was looking for a young girl that had the kind of innocence, but with a kind of a more mature edge it was quite a specific kind of person that I was looking for. So then having found her, she then shifts the role that she then takes up in my imagination, and then that grows. And then, you know, an idea that I thought might work with her just doesn't, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I'll go somewhere else with it.
Okay. Yeah. And do you work from life or photos or a combination of both?
Can be a combination of both if it's more portrait-based, so commissions. But, yeah, typically I prefer to take to, because the images are so sort of clear and defined in my mind's eye, I want to take photographic reference so that I can then come back, and I work in a slow, you know, layered process. So, it's, yeah, I need many hours back in the studio to do the technical side of things, and, yeah. So.
And when you're taking the photos, are you directing the models? Are you like, this is what I have in mind? And
yeah. As I say, I'll start with the idea that I want to make sure that I get, and then around that, other things will happen, and other angles that haven't occurred to me will stand out as being, you know, something that I want to investigate as well. And just, you know, as the model starts to interact with the costumes or the props that I brought in, you know, that will influence it as well. And it always develops. So it's sort of, you have the ingredients for the idea that you've got, and then you can sort of, you know, bake it into any number of different, you know. That's a really bad analogy.
Bake it. I thought you said fake it. Oh, okay. Yeah, right.
I was going down some sort of, you know, rubbish kind of
cook. All right. This is what happens when you read cookery books in the bath.
Yeah, exactly. You read that. Ignore that. Scratch that.
No, that's brilliant. That's it. That's podcast gold.
Oh, God. Right.
Oh, yeah. In a photo shoot, do you like go, okay, I'm going to do this one photo shoot for this one idea that I have, or do you try and do a lot of coverage to maybe get, you know, multiple paintings out of the one photo shoot?
Yeah, I would try to. I mean, A, because it's not always that easy to bring a photo shoot together. You know, often that it means, you know, I'm traveling a good distance, the model's traveling a good distance, you know, I've hired a location or a studio. So all of the logistics of it tend to be, A, expensive, time-consuming, and they take a lot of planning. So, you know, quite a few, you know, often Georgie or Mason are very busy. They don't, you know, they don't always necessarily have that many days available. So, yeah, if I'm going to catch them, I'll try and make the most of it.
Right.
And also because I, you know, I don't want... if you just simply try and do one image and then move on to a completely separate thing, I think you're losing opportunities to develop that. You know, there always will be other sides to an idea. You know, there are other meanings, there are other slightly different, you know, shifts in a narrative that might, you know, broaden the meaning that you first came up with, and maybe, you know, make you think of it in a slightly different way, which could be more interesting. So yeah, always being open to that, but making the most of the time that I've got with them is important.
So when you get all your photo reference back, do you composite like on Photoshop the best of or the idea, or do you have it all up and you know, on a board kind of thing, and you're working from that as you're painting?
Really composite. I mean, I do tend to zoom in to details, so there will have to be some element of kind of working from different photographs to get different aspects of the image. But I don't tend to do too much post work. I mean, yeah, I won't tend to sort of collage it together so much.
Right.
But I might do a bit of that on the panel itself while I'm drawing out. You're effectively collaging it on the piece, but I don't do that in Photoshop. Although I think that could be really interesting, and I sort of that's quite a few years ago. I kind of nearly went down an avenue of developing more work like that, and, you know, maybe sort of adding in kind of different software packages that could help you create a world that doesn't exist at all. You know, I'm quite fascinated by Ray Caesar's work. I love it. I really adore what he does. I think it's incredibly. I think there's Sean Lane. And he, again, works in a similar way, which is to create so Ray Cesar, are you familiar with his work? You know, he creates 3D models within, I think it's one of the 3D software packages, I can't remember its name. And then he will, they are beautiful sort of paintings in a digital sense, but they're from 3D models that he's constructed. Beautifully done. And then Sean will paint from the reference that he's constructed. So he'll create digital reference and then make fantastic oil paintings from them. That's fascinating. And if you could mix that with live models as well, I think that's quite an exciting thing. I haven't investigated that so much, but I would like to.
Yeah. Okay. And then before you start, do you do colour studies or value studies or anything like that?
Yeah, value studies. I mean, they tend to be, sometimes they'll end up under the laser paint. So I might, I'm exploring as I'm sort of putting the painting down. So different layers are doing different things for me. So I suppose I could do them on a separate panel sometimes. Sometimes I do. Often I'm exploring as the foundation layers of the painting.
Right, but you don't do a little small version of the bigger picture, like for colour or that kind of thing?
I don't, not as a rule,
As a rule. All right. Okay, this is a question from the Patreon community. It's from artist Laura Atkins, and she asks, what do you set up your charcoal drawings with?
Is she meaning in terms of setting them afterwards? So... To fix them.
I was hoping you'd know what she meant, actually.
Ah, right, that's it. I think maybe she...
Yeah, I thought fixative maybe was that she was talking about, was it?
Yeah. I don't fix them. I got slightly concerned about the idea of adding another chemical into the paint layer. So I tend to kind of brush off any excess charcoal. More recently, actually, I've been drawing with an oil-based pencil, which just integrates into the paint layer. So, I mean, charcoal does as well. So I don't mind, you know, sometimes you'll get a bit of the charcoal moving around, but in the underpainting layers, that's not too bad. Because of the surface I work on, it tends to stick, there'll be enough charcoal just to leave a faint ghost of the drawing. So it's fine.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
If you use fixative on a panel, it will make an already fairly non-porous support even less, able to take, because you want to keep as much of the chemical bond between the paint and the panel.
Yeah.
And if you've got another layer of fixative, that's blocking that mechanical process. It may not be making a huge difference, but I think it makes enough for me to feel the sensation of a slippier. You know, it feels like I've got like a varnish layer, which isn't. I don't think that's great for paint layers.
Okay. Well, speaking of the surface you work on, I'm going to jump forward because somebody asked about the aluminium panels. Hang on one sec. Where is it? Oh, yeah. It's from John Chambers again. Oh, this is a serious question. how and why paint on aluminium panels?
This many, many years ago. This is in about, I think, 2004. Or 2005, I got a commission for a really lovely family in Myanmar where the humidity was about 85%. And at that time, I was working on canvas and I realized this wasn't going to work for somewhere. They said that they'd had problems with some of the paintings that they'd taken over there. So I hacked about, and although I had painted on some wooden panels, I was aware that they weren't going to stand up to it either. So I ended up speaking to the Tate. And the Tate Conservation Department were really helpful. And we talked through a number of options. And one thing that they suggested was this product called Dye Bond, aluminium composite panel, which they back their photographic collection onto.
Oh, right, yeah.
So they use it because it's so stable. It's not going to flex with any environmental conditions. And it's very light. You can, it's incredibly convenient in all sorts of ways. And I started adhering linen canvas to it. Didn't so much like the way that that worked, and found through experimentation that I really like painting on it as a surface. So yeah, continue doing that.
Right. And where do you get that?
You can get it quite a number of the online, you know, art stores, art supply stores will sell it now. It's quite expensive to buy it in that way. Or you can go direct to, I mean, it's a commercial product. It's designed for signage.
Right.
And so it's designed to sort of stand up to all sorts of weather conditions. So it's coated with a coating that will stand up to all sorts of conditions. So it's you can safely buy it from, you know, a sign supplies. It's going to be just as good quality as the stuff you buy from the art suppliers, but it's going to be cheaper. So shop around, you can get it for really, you know, good price.
Yeah, and you can get better sizes from the advertising guys as well, can't you?
Yeah, I think it goes up to a maximum of something like 2.20 meters or something like that. I think that's the longest dimension. There might be a 2.5 meter piece. So if you're going any bigger than that, you need to start bracing them and joining them. For most of us, that's pretty reasonable size.
Yeah. How thick is it?
It varies. I think you can get a 3 mil and a 5 mil.
Yeah, right.
But the aluminium itself is only, you know, a fraction of that, because majority of that is the poly core.
It's the core, yeah.
Yeah, so it just keeps it. Yeah, so it keeps it light. I like the sense of the slightly thicker one, to be honest. But either's fine.
And when you get it, is it it's not primed or anything like that? You would have to do all that, do you?
Yeah, no. It's not primed. It is. I mean, technically, it is in a sense, because it's already got a coating. You can buy it with a variety of different coatings. You can get clear stuff, but you just want to make sure that you're not buying aluminium that is raw. I've had a couple of people contact me about painting on aluminium panels and misunderstanding that what they're buying is sheet aluminium, which is absolutely not. Not a great idea to use.
That'd be heavy, wouldn't it?
Incredibly heavy, and also, you know, yeah, oxidizes, and your paint layers will just peel off. You don't want to be using stuff unless you prime it really, really well. Yeah, so don't use that. But you can do pretty much anything to the coating that's already on aluminium panel composite panels. That coating is pretty. I think it's baked on, so it's pretty tough to get that off. So you sand it, you can make a tooth to it, you can then gesso on top of it, do all your, you know, all of, you know, prime it as you would any other painting surface.
Okay. Yeah. Do you think you could take a orbital sander to it?
I would be gentle with that, because I have an orbital sander, and I used to do that because I put about 12 layers of gesso on all my panels, and then went through a phase of using the orbital sander. Actually, to be honest, I was getting a better result, and it keeps you a bit fitter to do it by hand. Just a little wet and dry block, you know, those little squeezy. Do you know the ones I mean? They're brilliant.
Yep.
Just a little wet and dry sponge, sanding sponge, and there's a fine layer on them. Just use the fine layer and keep it wet, and it'll give you a really nice result.
I had Alicia Armstrong on the podcast a while ago, and she is a big fan of her orbital sander, and she works on wood panels. It's part of her painting process. Curious if you could have at it the way she does with the orbital sander.
Oh, absolutely. Well, who doesn't love a bit of power tool action in the studio? I mean, I've often taken one to a painting. You know, there's been a couple of times when that's been, you know, incredibly satisfying. Just to take the paint back off again. I'm just like, enough of that. But if that works for other artists, it's great. It cuts down some of the time, definitely. Is she working on really big panels as well?
She makes these lovely abstract paintings first, and she uses the orbital sander a lot in them, and then she paints the figures into the abstract landscape that she's created.
That's interesting.
Yeah, well, that's lovely stuff. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, awesome. Yeah, sounds good.
Okay, so you get your panels, you prime them, and then you do your charcoal, and you don't use a fixative, if we have got Laura's question right. And then you're a big fan of grisaille, is that right?
Yes, although I stopped. I'm not painting the level of finish to my grisaille as I used to. It's incredibly time-consuming process.
And really...
You do feel like you're painting it twice, in a sense. I mean, the reason I persevered with it is because you cannot get that same finish. I mean, you don't really see it if you see my work in reproduction. You know, I can see it in other painters. I can see those foundation layers, you know, are kind of unmistakable when you see it in the flesh, and you can't get that in a different. In another way. So it's something about this, just the tactile, you know. I love to actually, you know, feel the surface of the paint. It's a, you know, I have a, that gives me pleasure, just to, you know, feel the sensation of how smooth the layers of paint become, sort of eggshell smooth. It feels very, it's a very different quality optically as well. It kind of, light bounces off it in a different way. Yeah, but it takes so long to do that it was blocking me getting the ideas that I wanted to get down on camber, you know, on panel.
Yeah.
It was just taking too long to do that. So I'm sort of, some paintings I will still start like that. You know, sometimes I feel like I want that extra help for a particular area, and sometimes I'll sort of go straight in and, you know, go straight into colour. So it kind of depends.
And were your grisailles just black and white, or did you use a white and a color, or a little bit of, you know, other colors in?
I prefer it was actually more like a sepia, so it was an umber, very dark umber, I think, with a little bit of probably Payne's gray or something like that,
a bit of
black in there. But yes, yeah, so it's a warm dark.
Okay. And when you're getting into the color side of things, do you have a favorite color palette that you like to always use on each one, or is it different from painting to painting?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I think it makes, you know, it makes starting, you know, at the beginning of your painting session a lot simpler if you just stick to, you know, a set of colors that you're familiar with. And it also means that you can go straight to the mixes that you want, you know, you're familiar with how to get to a given, you know, colour that much quicker. And it just stops you having another one of those barriers to getting stuck in the sense of, you know, you've got your palette set up. It's not another decision-making process that you need to sort of deal with in the morning.
Yeah.
It's just there. So, yeah.
And do you have is it a big palette or a smallish, or what's kind of
smaller? About 10, yeah, between 8 and 10.
Okay.
Just your basics, you know. I tend not to have too much cadmium on my palette. I tend to sort of try and avoid, because I don't like painting in gloves, so I tend to avoid any kind of colour that I have to be too concerned about. But you know, if there's a red jacket in a painting, then, yeah, it'll have to be cadmium. Nothing else is going to cut it.
The gloves are on.
The gloves are on. There you go. Yeah.
Right, this is another question from Laura. What medium combo recipe do you use, as mine attracts lint sometimes?
Oh, yeah. Oh, the dreaded lint. It's everywhere. It's impossible to stop it completely. But if you're getting a lot of lint, then you're probably working with something sticky. So, yeah, a medium, any medium that's got a sticky element to it, resinous, you know, whether it's liquin or any of those sort of gelatinous, like oleo res gel, the alkyd kind of resinous mediums, are all going to attract a bit of lint, and any fluff hairs will just go straight to your work. And I think as well, one of the things that I think we probably don't take too much attention to is where we keep our brushes, and because a lot of the hairs come out of your brushes because they're sitting on your table by your work, and you know, they're sitting there the whole time picking up all sorts of stuff that's in the atmosphere in your studio. But if you want to avoid lint on the painting, stick to a medium that doesn't have that sticky element that's, and that props that's got something like a wax in it, so something that gives you a bit of slip but without stickiness. Things that have got silicone in as well, silica will do the same. So you can your paint will move around, but it's not going to give you a surface that will just stay sticky. It's going to dry sort of fairly matte. It gives you a bit of a break. But I'll sand the surface back, and I'll go over it with a very, very fine sandpaper and some magnifying goggles and a little scalpel, and just take dust and fluff off every now and then as well.
Right. And do you have a particular medium combo that you use, that you like to use?
I'll have a couple. So I'll try not to use too much medium as a whole. So I'll just have a solvent and a linseed oil mix, so pretty much 50-50, which is, which I'll sort of dip into and try and paint pretty much directly out of the tube. So if I need then to give any glaze layers, I like the solvent-free gel that Gamblin produce. I think it's called solvent-free gel. handily. That's great to work with, actually. But there is some stick to that. So, yeah, you're going to get some lint in it. But that's great for glazing. It's a really nice medium to work with. What else do I like? I mean, I will add a little bit of wax myself, and I put a little bit of wax in my varnish layers as well. So it just takes the, I don't like things to be too shiny. Yeah. Right. I was listening to your conversation with Pam Wilson, and I think you were talking about the way that Brad Kunkel enjoys the fact that the mirror surface of his gilded work allows the viewer to kind of interact so they can see themselves slightly.
Yeah.
And I was thinking that's really interesting, because that's the absolute opposite for me. I want you to be able to stand in front of, I don't like to be able to stand in front of a painting and see the reflection of the viewer. I want you just to, I don't want that to break your, the illusion of what you're looking at. So that was really interesting. I thought that was really nice to hear it from, Brad and what Brad had been saying, and I think Pam too. That it's really interesting that's another way of looking at it.
Yeah. Bizarrely, I heard an interview with Francis Bacon, and he was talking about his paintings. Right. It was all lovely, and he said, "Yes, they all have to be behind glass. It's not really finished until they're behind glass." Which I thought
who said that?
Francis Bacon.
Did he?
Yeah, he was like, "I don't like my paintings unless they're behind glass." And, you're talking about reflection. I know you can get non-reflective glass, but I think he actually liked that whole side of it, which is seemed very strange to me. But
that's totally not what I would have. Yeah, I would not have imagined that he would give it that level of. That seems sort of quite a almost like a afterthought, a kind of decorative afterthought, isn't it? Sort of how the glass affects it. Yeah, I would have thought he'd given that two thoughts. Yeah,
no, he was right into it.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah. Just going back to your process there, how do you check yourself as you're going along? Like, other artists will use mirrors, or they'll turn the canvas upside down, or they'll get critiques, or they'll take pictures on their phone. Or, well, what do you like to
do? Yeah, all of the above. I've got some reflective doors behind my easel. So I can just kind of turn my head and I can see it, and it's sort of diffuse enough not to get too distracting. I can just see the values that gives me a clue. Yeah, photographs on your phone are really good, because that reduces everything down. So again, you can just check the values quickly. I do turn it upside down, although that I don't like that so much. I know it means that you're painting what you see rather than what you think you see, but I still can't help but try and turn my head, so I end up painting with my head on one side, which is not a good way to spend your day, really. So and I think you just lose track of the way light hits as well. I think it's just that extra dimension that your brain doesn't quite read. And likenesses, you can lose a likeness really quickly by somehow, because it doesn't, a likeness is not just about getting absolutely right as your reference is. You know, there's something else that goes on, and I think if you lose that thread, you'll lose some life as if you lose that thread, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I know for myself, like, I never paint upside down. I'll turn it upside down just to shock myself or just to get a different perspective, but I don't paint upside down.
Yeah. Perhaps we should. Perhaps we should completely start it upside down and see what happens.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So I was enthusiastic about it. So I
Oh, well, no, I was thinking of, like, turning myself upside down as well. How would that work? But anyway, that's not what you meant.
Well, it'd probably be very good for your spine. No.
Oh, yeah, that's right, yeah. Okay, last question from Laura. When do you varnish, and what kind of varnish do you use?
Okay, well, I'd love to say that I have 6 months to wait, and then I, you know, varnish as every good artist should when they're fully dry. But thankfully, there are, you know, products like Gambar. You don't need to wait. I use Gambar. You can put it on as soon as it's touch dry, and the oil still can dry properly because it doesn't stop that oxidization process happening. So that's good to know. It's actually it's what the Conservation Department, the National Portrait Gallery, use as well. So that gives me an extra layer of confidence that, you know, it's kind of sanctioned by those that really know. So yeah, that's my go-to varnish. So I'll varnish really, you know, a day or two after it's touch dry.
Okay. Many layers or just one layer?
It as it's needed. I mean, different paintings might need a little bit more. If you've got more saturated colours, you might want a little bit of extra varnish. So maybe a second layer. Yeah, I rarely go third. Yeah.
All right. And based on what you're saying before, I'm guessing you go for more of a matte varnish than a gloss varnish.
Yeah, it's more like a satin. Ideally, it would be a satin finish.
If you're enjoying this podcast, remember you can support it by going to patreon.com/John Dalton gently does it. Do you ever want to, like, let rip and splash the paint around a bit and do a bit of action painting or anything like that?
Well, I kind of do in my underlying, you know, my underpainting layers. There's room for kind of splashing about there. Yeah, like maybe, but I end up coming back to wanting to refine layers too much. To kind of leave those, you know, sometimes it's nice to. I think that's what I've really enjoyed about things like Instagram is being able to have those phases of a painting exist, you know, and somewhere, stay as a record. And looking back at them, I do often kind of think, well, that's always a nice point at which maybe to stop, or, you know, those are good points to keep as a study. Take somewhere else. So yeah. Yeah,
and I was kind of curious where do you sort of see the spontaneity happen in your creative process, or is there space for, like, happy accidents?
There is definitely quite a few of the pieces that I'm doing at the moment. I actually, having said what we said at the beginning about how that my images come pretty much fully formed and fixed.
Yeah.
There are quite a few pieces that have been. I don't know where I'm going to take several of the pieces that I'm working on at the moment. Then they've been evolving, so I've been adding elements to them, extra elements to them.
Right.
So yeah, that's really exciting for me actually, because it's a real jumping off the cliff moment with a painting that you just don't know where you're going to go with it next, and that's really different for me, and it's really exciting, and I think that's the space that becomes, you know, really worthwhile. Then you're doing something that could be. I mean, it could completely fail, but it could be much better than you envisaged. You know, and it's that keeps the sort of energy, you know, firing for it, which is what you need. You gotta keep that sort of, you know, that passion for striving to get it somewhere that you couldn't even have imagined when you started it. You know?
Yeah. Here's another question from Instagram. It kind of relates to what you were saying, actually. And this time it's from artist Jenny Gunn in New Zealand. And she asks, what percentage of your work goes to the gallery and what percentage ends up in the skip?
Oh, right. I thought she was... did she mean in terms of the selling price percentage? No. So how much do I chuck away?
Yeah. Because that's the flip side of what you were saying, you know, like when you don't know where it's going, sometimes it can go into some place you didn't want it to go.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess that's probably, I've had three or four pieces that I started for this show's worth of work that I've ditched. Yeah, that I've just, yeah, so it's probably in a given group of 20 paintings, then maybe three or four of them I'll start and not take any further. So I think I'm getting better at spotting quicker which are the ones that aren't going to work. So yeah. That's soul destroying when you've virtually finished something and then you suddenly realize a huge chunk of it didn't work. It just isn't going to work, and you can completely ruin something because, you know, you've got a hand that doesn't work, you know, or just something that your eye just can't work out how to save. You know, you can't salvage something just because of some small passage on the paint. Incredibly frustrating. So, spotting those things early enough to just go, right, that's enough energy wasted on that, and ditch it.
And when you ditch it, do you just sand it back or do you actually chuck it?
Sometimes I'll sand it back or sometimes I'll just turn it towards the wall, put something in front of it, stop thinking about it. Yeah, otherwise you just can't, and I can't leave it. I want to solve the problem. I want to keep, you know, and it drives me mad.
All right. There's a lot written about how women painting women is very different to men painting women. Do you think that's true?
I think, yeah, I mean, there's, yeah, inevitably we have a different quality to our gaze in the sense that we're looking at an autobiographical rather than a subjective, objective kind of, that's putting it quite badly, but if I'm painting another woman, I'm painting a woman that is either a side of myself or a friend or a relation, or there's a different meaning that I'm conveying in my work that a man would not be able to do. You know, there's always going to be an autobiographical element. So yeah, so that's that. Yes, that's going to be fundamentally different. In terms of technically, no, I can't. I would say there's no difference. There's going to be a subjective difference.
Because in the things I read when people were making a point about that to do with your work, they were talking about how your model stares straight back at you and there's a real person there and that kind of thing. To me, it seemed more like just different people paint differently. I wasn't so sure if it was a women painting women thing, but then I'm not a woman, so I don't know. That's why I'm asking you.
Yeah, I don't know. I think probably having the subject look at the viewer always engages a different... So that figure becomes less of an object that you're observing without that figure knowing about it. You know, they are looking at you and they're challenging you, and there's much more of a meeting on an equal basis between, you know, that character canvas and you as the onlooker. So it shifts that. Yeah, I tend just to be attracted more in terms of the interest that an image holds for me when I'm engaged with the sitter's, you know, gaze. When they're looking directly at me, I feel like they're engaging me. That just makes me more involved with the painting.
Okay, brace yourself. I'm going to ask you the terrible Vincent Desiderio question. What contribution do you think you're making to the history of art?
Oh, gosh. Does anybody start their day with that thought? What a hellish proposition that would be. no. No, I think that's that way madness lies. I think... gosh, I think you can probably consider it in retrospect. Maybe if you really got to dwell on that. I think it's hard enough to do it and stick with it and make a life doing it without thinking that you've also got to consider leaving it as some kind of legacy for future generations. I think do it, enjoy it, get the most out of it you possibly can, and not worry too much about how anyone else sees it. That's probably my overriding thought, rather than I'm not sure that is going to do very much other than paralyze you. I think that would hinder your ideas process. I mean, I think it helps you to be as free as possible and not feel that you're being, you know, judged or watched or looked at. You, if you can feel that you're in your own vacuum creating your works, then I think that's much healthier, much more free way to work than worrying about what you're going to be judged to have done with it. Yeah, right. I don't know. What about you, John? What do you think?
I think it's a good question to ask yourself. I think it's one of those questions that if you expect to get an answer, you'll go nuts. But think when you think about the history of art and you think about your place in it and what your if you think of it like a conversation, what bit are you going to add to the conversation? I think it's actually a terrible question. It's one of those impossible questions. But I think it's worth asking. Since I talked to him and since I kind of came across the idea of it, I do notice that it does sort of, it's not like I'm, feel like I'm standing on the top of a mountain, waiting for two stone tablets about the history of art or anything like that. It's not dramatic or anything like that. But it does, it has changed it just a little bit of, it's sort of going, well, it's not, I'm not just messing about here. I could, if I was going to have a contribution, what would it be? And just leave that kind of hanging there, in the background somewhere, and then just get on with it,
Absolutely. I mean, it's another thing to kind of add a little bit more grist to your mill, maybe, if it's, it's like it could be something that you're reacting against, and just saying, well, solve that. I'm not going to allow myself to feel that pressure as well.
I'm not going to join the conversation. I'm not saying anything.
You shouldn't have to. I mean, or it can be something absolutely. I mean, I will probably, I will take. I haven't listened to that episode, so I will go and listen to that now because I think that I'd be really interested to hear what his take is on that.
It's quite good. All right, I'm not sure if I got this right, but are you a vegetarian or a vegan?
No, I used to be. I used to be while I was, many years ago when I went at college, I was for about 8 years until, I used to do all sorts of rubbish jobs to pay my way through college. And one of them was working in a kebab shop. And being vegetarian in a kebab shop is not great. But I stuck through it. But I eat meat now. A little bit, not so much.
Okay. Do you have a big dream you'd like to achieve before you die?
Probably achieving some of the images that I've had in my mind for about the last, couple of years is my next, that's the next dream. Before I die, oh gosh, again, that's verging into that whole legacy.
Well, I meant just, to put it like at some point, because you can have a big dream I don't mean a big dream like for next year or anything like that, but just something that you'd, in the back of your mind, you'd love to do that now before whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, there are a number of things that I'd like to do with my partner. Cause we have, as I say, he's a musician and I think that both of us have talked a number of times about having we're living somewhere where we could invite other artists, other musicians, and we could have a kind of a retreat, so that a creative retreat, because I think that's fascinating when you have people from completely different disciplines sit down around a dinner table, you get the wine flowing and you're talking, you get so many so many inspirations that, that everybody feeds off. And I think we both really like to do that and to kind of open our hearts to do that. So, yeah, I think that's something. And doing some teaching as well, it's not something I've had a chance to do, but I'm starting to book some portrait workshops in September. I'm going to be doing one then. So that's something that I would like to do more of. Maybe a bit of mentoring as well, because I think it's something that I feel like I could, on a more of a one-to-one basis, I think that's something that I could help with, somebody with. We'll see. It's all got to fit around kind of, honouring commitments that I've made for shows and commissions. And so, you always have to sort of balance it with things that you've already kind of got down in the, committed to. So,
quite a few of the artists I've talked to do that one-to-one mentoring, but they do it online, and they find that they can fit that into their studio practice quite easily.
Yeah, I've done a little bit like that, and that works really well. And I think, it teaches us as much, doesn't it? I mean, as soon as you have to sit down and think about your process to sort of share it with somebody else, you realise from somebody else's take on it, what's important about that.
And your portrait workshops, are they on your website, or is there somewhere else that people can go?
No, not yet. They will be, but not yet. We haven't finalised the details, but the first one's will be in Yorkshire in September.
Okay. And where can people sign up for your creative retreat with your partner?
No, that's
I'm joking.
That's a dream for the future. I better let him know.
I could hear the frightened silence at the other end there.
I'm sure it'll happen.
Yeah, no, it's a lovely idea, and you're right. Anytime I've seen that happen, it's great. Okay, if there was, again, this is a hard question, if there's one underlying theme to all your work, what do you think it might be?
I think there are several. I think that's probably something that I'm still exploring and working out. And I think especially at this point, I don't know. I mean, it's we're at a really difficult phase, aren't we, at the moment, in terms of what's happening in both in Britain and in the States. There's some seismic fundamental shifts, politically, socially, there are so many things that are shifting into a place that none of us are familiar with, that I don't know, that is creeping more and more and more into my work. So it's becoming less, it was always, always very specific and autobiographical, specific to me. And now it's becoming more broader and a wider meaning. But I don't tend to want to specify it too much, in a sense, because I feel like it's slightly like explaining a joke. Do you know what I mean? You lose part of the magic of allowing people to bring what they bring to paintings if you kind of specify too much about what the meaning is. And it's nice to kind of allow the idea to evolve, because also I think sometimes I think that I'm doing a painting on a particular topic, but then realize later down, it might be months or it might be years down the line that I meant something completely different. It meant something completely different. Allowing them to be sort of intuitively meaningful for me as well as the viewer, I think, is probably, I prefer to kind of enjoy it like that.
So you, in terms of underlying themes, would you put them in the same kind of, because a meaning is different to a kind of a theme,
because
you would have the, you'd have your whole body of work that you've done, it'd be all very clear in your mind. So each individual painting would have its own little story and narrative and meaning open-ended meanings and space for other meanings, but the themes are what would run through all your work?
I mean, there's always going to be that element, I think, that we were talking about initially, of the sitter being, you know, the subject being as much about the sitter. I mean, I do quite a bit of commissioned portrait work, so that definitely influences the two sort of distinct areas of my work, kind of influence each other. I don't know in terms of a theme. There is, and somebody else will spot it, and they'll be sitting there thinking, you know, shouting at the, you know, your podcast. For God's sake, woman, have you not realised? But, you know, maybe I don't at this point. Maybe I haven't worked it out. You know.
Yeah.
Maybe that's why I'm doing it. You know, I'm trying to work it out.
Okay, this is another question from Instagram. This one's from Norwegian artist Hovard Loveness. I hope I'm probably slaughtered that name, but anyway.
Well, rather you than me.
I think I got the Hovard bit right, but I'm sure it's sure about the surname. Anyway, he asks, how has the BP Portrait Award affected your career?
That's interesting. That's interesting. Actually, I think the most important thing that the BP Award gave to me is the fact that it was a benchmark of a level of quality that I wanted to reach with my work before I showed it publicly. So I sort of, it was one of the exhibitions that I saw whilst I was studying. I was at college. I did an illustration degree, and fairly quickly realised that wasn't really what I was interested in. And I saw the BP Portrait Award, and it absolutely sort of transfixed me with, this is what I want to be in this show. I want my work to look, to be of a quality that would earn its right to be here. So having a goal technically like that made me work privately. I didn't want to show my work until I sort of hit a level that I thought was reasonable to start trying to show it. And that was the sort of benchmark for me. So it was important on that level. It's certainly a fantastic, you know, it's the biggest shop window in going in terms of, you know, in the UK, certainly. And I think, you know, and more recently now it's worldwide, it has, you know, carried over to the States, and it gives a lot of people their first experience of showing internationally, you know, and it introduces people internationally to different opportunities. So, and it certainly gave me some, I think it was the impetus rather than the specific opportunities that it gave me that has been the most important, because it can also, I think if you're trying to specifically work as a portrait painter without doing gallery shows as well, then it's much more important. But if you're trying to do the two, then there's always, you know, it's important to try and keep a balance on the amount of portrait work that you take on. So that's something that I've tried to do, is not take too many. They are, they take sort of more out of me in a sense, and they take a lot longer. And they're a different side of you know, my creative process. So I do feel like they are distinct things. And I try not to do more than sort of two or three portrait commissions a year.
Right.
Because otherwise I will lose the threads that might be running through other paintings that I'm wanting to do for gallery, for my shows.
So if I was, if I'm reading between the lines here of Hovard's question, if he's kind of going, is it worth his, you know, from a career point of view, would it be worth his while to enter the,
absolutely,
the competition? Yeah. And maybe he's not saying that. I could be making that up, but.
No, it certainly would. I mean, it does. There is no question that it can bring some great commissions, some great opportunities. It may well be the only art show that a huge amount of people go to. You know, it's the most visited contemporary painting exhibition, group exhibition in the UK, as far as I'm aware. You know, has been for a long time. So, you know, people that are not going to see any other painting in their year, that's, you know, they're the 53 paintings that those people will go and see. You know, and it'll be, you know, if you're lucky, they use your image for promotion like they did for mine, and it carries, and
it's all over London, wasn't it?
I know, and it stays there, and it stays in people's minds, and I'm still getting people who said, I did a commission last year for a girl who saw, one of the first paintings that I ever put in, I think in 2004, and it stays with people, and they keep the postcards, and they keep the books, and many years later, people will reach out and get in contact and say, I saw that when I was young, and I couldn't commission then. I didn't have the wherewithal to commission, but now I do, or maybe, now they have their children, or they're at a different point in life, and they'll come back and do it.
Yeah, I was listening to an interview with Sean Cheatham, and exactly the same thing happened to him. I'm not even sure if he was nominated. I think he was nominated. He didn't win or anything, but they used his for publicity, so he was all over London as well, his submission.
It was a fantastic piece. I love that piece of Sean's. I remember it. Yeah.
Okay, I have a couple of questions from American artist Brian Fox, and his first one is... you seem to work exclusively with galleries. How many paintings, on average, per year do you have to create for them to keep them happy and to survive as an artist?
Well, that's a good question. Now, I wonder what he means by exclusively, because I'm producing work for a given show at any one time, and during the year, that probably constitutes 25 paintings, I think.
Right.
Yeah, that's about my work rate. That's not much more than that. That's about 25. That's about me at full throttle. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, that's about a kind of manageable amount.
That's over two and a bit a month.
Yeah. Well. I was listening to the podcast with Pam again, and I thought it was really interesting that she was saying how she spent the last 3 years exhaustingly trying to stick to the promises she's made, her commitments that she's made to exhibitions, and that's a huge pressure to do that. And I guess I've pretty much been doing that. I've had 10 years of kind of really being flat out. Flat out. And yeah, I mean, 25 is probably the max that I can do. I mean, to be honest, I don't count it so much. I might look back and at the end of the year and kind of realise, it was this many, but yeah, maybe 20. But I think I've definitely got to a stage where I'm thinking, for my own health and well-being, I have to try and do just what I can do, but also... if you're full throttle, you can't produce the pieces that you really want to produce. So about a year and a half ago, partly this was behind the move away from Brighton, was that I decided that I would stop that process, that I would stop working to a defined show, that I would step back and I'd kind of invest in the images that I wanted to, the images in my head that I was going to invest in, the time enough to step out of the gallery process and paint the images that I'm desperate to get out. So, giving myself enough of a run of, 12, 18 months where I don't have a commitment, that I'm not booking something in, and allowing myself time to kind of, flounder on stuff, to experiment on it, to come up with things that I haven't tackled before, and to do it so that I'm not doing that all completely in public as well, because for the last 10 years, pretty much everything that I produced has gone out one way or another and has ended up in a show.
Yeah.
So, yeah, not feeling that that's got to be my end goal with each piece, and that I'm doing it simply because those are the images that I have to produce rather than... because I have a deadline, that I want those, So yeah, it's something I squirreled my money away and my time away and kind of cleared the decks and
give yourself a bit of space. Yeah, sounds good.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay, here's his next question. Do you find collectors and or galleries ask for a specific size of painting more than other sizes? In other words, do you see a trend of one size selling better than the other?
Okay. Thankfully, I've always shown with galleries that don't tell me anything like that. They don't ask me for a certain size. I've been very lucky in the sense that they've kind of left me to do what I do without trying to influence that. Latterly I've sort of come across people that do that. I don't find that very helpful. Obviously you're aware if things tend to, I try not to think too much about whether or not something is going to sell before starting it. Yeah, I think that starts to get into a bit of, if you try and second guess what's going to sell and how big you need to do because of, you know, the financial kind of implications of it. I mean, yes, I'm not doing, you know, 12-foot canvases, but then I would only be able to do one of those every 18 months, you know.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Yes, I need to be bringing some money in, but yeah, maybe that's something I just haven't thought about so much more recently. It's a different stage that I'm at.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like your galleries are not hassling you about it anyway. So I think if they're not being hassled about it, it wouldn't really occur to you, would it?
No, not so much. Not so much. I'm grateful for it. Yeah, I think that's it's certainly. I didn't realize that there were galleries that would be very specific about, you know, dimensions and colors and subject matter, and you know, I find that quite shocking.
Yeah, no, I've had a few artists talk about that. Yeah. That they have,
really?
You know, yeah. Like I had the first one that springs to mind is Mike Levitt, who's a sculptor, and he went to his gallery with this idea for his next exhibition, and he laid it all out what the idea for the exhibition was, and they were like, oh yeah, that's really good. We think you should do this. And they basically suggested a completely different direction from him. Now, luckily, he thought, yeah, that's a better idea. I'm going to do that. But yeah, it was to that level of intervention. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Gosh, wow. Wow. Well, good on him. If it did inspire him, not just turned him off, you know, I mean, I think I've occasionally had somebody suggest a direction to me and it shuts me down. I can't. It's not something that comes, you know, externally very easily. Yeah. But I don't know what I'm saying there. But, you know, I don't find that outside influence very helpful. Mm. But, yeah, good on him. Good on him for, you know, rolling with it. And, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And it's great. I saw that. I saw what he finished, what he did, the finish. It was a series of, movie directors mashed up with their movies, if you know what I mean, the sculptures.
Right.
Lovely sculptures,
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, right, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, another one that I need to go and look at afterwards.
Yeah, they're all great. They are all great.
Excellent.
Okay, here's Brian's last question. Do you get more of your collectors through galleries or on your own, like through social media, magazine articles, and through your own exposure?
I don't tend to know many people that if they bought something through one of the galleries, then I won't necessarily get to know. Occasionally, I do. I mean, and generally speaking, my gallery has been pretty good at, you know, if they have a good collector that wants to be put in touch, they will certainly put them in touch with me. You know, and likewise, I'll keep them posted about what then happens. You know, obviously that's important. I cut the gallery out. Obviously I don't do that. That's important to respect the work that they've done. But so the majority of the commissions that are coming to me are probably through social media or through direct on something that they've seen of mine online.
Yeah, direct contact. Okay. That kind of leads into my question.
Yeah.
I saw that on your website you say that Ang Caravaggio, and this is a quote from you, right? Ang Caravaggio and Vermeer, they were the artists who literally moved me to tears in front of their paintings.
Yeah.
And it shocked me at the time that paintings could do that. So I'm just curious, bearing that in mind, how do you feel about the way people view art now, which is mostly on smartphones?
Online. Yeah, it's a real shame, isn't it? Because it doesn't. I think what worries me most is that young painters starting out can't see the difference between the quality of the images, that they, when you see something online, you lose so much of the technical qualities of it that you have to see something in the flesh to be able to translate that under your own brush. You know, you can't possibly take from it all that a great painting has to give if you're only seeing it online. And I think you can see that in some, you know, painters' work when they're beginning, they can't make that aesthetic, you know, judgment about how to get a given finish, because they're only seeing things in reproduction. They're only seeing things, you know, on the backlit screen. It's not translating.
Yeah.
Yeah, and just the scale shift, you lose so much, you know. We've probably all done this when you go into a gallery and you see a piece that you thought was, you know, 6 feet wide, and it's actually the size of a postage stamp, or vice versa, you know, you've got a completely different perception. You know, a painting means something completely different, and you get a totally different sensation back from it if it's tiny, much smaller than you thought, or wow, this is much bigger than I thought, you know, and the colours are completely different, and you're seeing so much more detail, and, you know. You lose so much. You lose so much not seeing stuff in the flesh. And you know, really upsets me that, you know, if you do have access to great galleries, you know, even those lucky people that have access to great galleries and can see them on a regular basis, you're only seeing 25% of the paintings that they have anyway, because the rest is in storage, and we probably don't get to see, you know, so much of the you know, the world's great paintings are in storage, you know, or they're in private collections and you never get to see them anyway.
Yeah, that's the flip side, is that although it is heartbreaking that, you know, you can only look at them on a little tiny screen, or even, you know, even on your computer, it's still not the same. But people are seeing a lot more art than they would have if those little screens weren't around.
Absolutely, and that's only a good thing, that you're seeing more. I mean, maybe the thing there is that, you know, it leads enough people then to go and see them in the flesh as well. I mean, it's whetting enough new appetites, and more people are sort of picking up a brush that than would have done otherwise. You know, it becomes something that, you know, everybody realizes they can do.
Yeah. And what's around, and what's been around, and
it's like music, isn't it? Because, you know, suddenly everything's new. Everything's effectively contemporary, because if you've never come across Angra before, or you've never come across, you know, the Beatles before, you know, suddenly you've got these classics, and they're as new to you as if they'd only just come out. So you're really lucky to be able to discover those things afresh, you know.
Yeah. When you think back on all the paintings that you've made so far, is there any one that kind of stands out that was particularly moving for you to make?
Yes, probably the portrait of my dad that I had in the BP in 2012, I think it was, or was it? Yeah, I think it was 2012 or 2011, 2013, I can't really remember. Yeah, that was very emotional to paint. I think it's not until you sort of sit down and paint, especially one of your, you know, closest relations, and because of the nature of the way that I paint as well, it's very, every thread of the jacket that he was wearing, and every, you know, every little line on his face, you know, and you realize how completely affecting every one of those little lines on my dad's face was, you know. And spending time with that person when you're painting that intricately, you know, you are with that person. And I think it gives you, I feel like I'm spending, I think David Cassan said the same about when he was painting his portrait of his mum that was in the BP a few years ago. You know, he said it was an opportunity to spend more time with her. And that's absolutely true, you know. It was also really emotional for me with my dad, because he just lost his hearing, and he was a huge music fan, and losing that pleasure in life, you know, was really emotional for him. And really sad for me to see, you know, something that he'd just gone. So yeah, I was you're going through all those thoughts, and as you're sitting down, spending time with them like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was very emotional.
Okay. What's the biggest challenge you're facing at the moment as an artist?
Gosh, I could give you a list technically. It's getting out of my head the images that I need to and I want to without, this is why I said to you that I need to clear the decks and stop having to work to commitments. I need to take myself completely out of that and have some time to kind of completely regenerate some of the ideas and those themes that I couldn't specify earlier on. But, you know, maybe this is the point at which I will really start to kind of rehash them, because I think it is a real watershed point in my life right now, I think. And it is kind of something that, you know, absolutely, you know, I've just lost my mom, and that is a completely, it puts such a different perspective on where I'm going at this point and how I'm seeing everything that I'm doing. So it can't help but shift everything. You know, it's a different world to me now. So so that needs to come out in my work.
Right.
So yeah, that's probably the challenge now.
Is giving yourself the space for that to come out.
Yeah. And letting it come out. And I mean, it's part and parcel of our lives, isn't it? What we're doing is not just this, it's not just a thing we do. It's our lives. It's every thought process. It's all in there.
Yeah. Very good. Okay. This is my last question. I ask this to everyone who comes on the podcast. If there's one thing you could pass on to future generations, what would it be? Doesn't have to be to do with art.
Just make it yourself that you're doing this for. Be your own harshest critic, and don't listen to too much from outside, to be honest. If it's you that you're trying to please with every work, then you've got the potential for every painting to make you happy. You know, these it's the successes that you find with every little breakthrough, with every little bit of achievement, and with every little problem that you solve, that are the things that satisfy. And then you've got the, you know, then there are the wider things that the external kind of feedback that you might get from that, then that's great. But if you don't, you know, in your gut feel that you're improving, that you're hitting the right notes for yourself, then it's always going to feel hollow. You know, it's got that you've got to be feeling from the gut that it's right for you and that you're impressing yourself, you know. And there's always the sort of law of diminishing returns, you know, as you each bit that you improve, you know, it's going to be only a more subtle improvement, you know, and that's fine. But you've got to keep challenging, and you've got to keep stretching, and you've got to keep feeling that new passion and that new energy and that new drive, and that's got to come from inside you.
Very good.
Oh, I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. I like it.
It's very a really good. Tricky one, isn't it? Yeah. I don't know about you. I mean, I suppose all of us kind of have something that we're trying to, somebody we're trying to impress, but, you know, hopefully it's you.
Yeah, well, that's right, isn't it? I mean, it's you're the only one in there. If you're not happy, it doesn't matter how many other people like it, you know.
I know, exactly. You've got to stand in the studio all day, you know, and if it's not fun, then what's it for?
That's right.
Yeah.
Okay, so your website is your name, very easy website, maryjaneansel.com. You're on Facebook and Instagram. You're very active on both, which is nice. You say thank you to people when they like your stuff and say nice things about you. You say thank you. That's very nice to see. You're not rock star about it. You're interactive.
No, I really appreciate it. No, and Instagram, I love. I am on Twitter.
Oh, that's right, Twitter as well. Yeah,
yeah. I don't. I sort of. I have. kind of dropped out of interacting with Twitter so much, although, but yeah, I'm there.
And I think they are linked from your website. If they don't, I'll put a link in the show notes to them as well. So yeah, it's been lovely chatting with you. And
bless John, it's been really good fun. It's good fun. You're going to have such a job editing all of these ums and ahs, and yeah. But I'm sure you're up to the task. I'm sure you're up.
Yeah, you're not the worst by any stretch. Don't worry.
Good.
Yeah, I really love your paintings. I think they're so breathtakingly good. Like the first time I came across them, because like we're talking about Instagram, you know, you can get into a bit of a swipe kind of frenzy where you're like, you know, you just go through them very fast. But yours are very arresting. Every time I've come across any of them, it just stops me in my tracks. Technically, on the technical front, for sure. But then also, they've got that, you know, indefinable quality of there's something going on there. What's that going on? Why is that person doing that? Why are they looking that way? Why that with that? You know, all that sort of stuff, which is brilliant and very good. So, yeah, so well done. And thanks for putting all the effort in, because that kind of technical excellence doesn't come easy, I know. And it's great.
That's good to hear.
Yeah, it's a real benchmark of, you know, that's, you know, a level of excellence that can be achieved. It's very, very inspiring. So, yeah, thanks
very
much. And yeah, it's been lovely to get to know you a little bit as a person as well, and find out what's going on behind that and how you get to those places.
Yeah. Oh, you too. I think this is a fantastic resource, and it kind of feels like it's almost like a conversation that the artists are having with each other, of all the people that you've been talking to. It's kind of a conversation once removed between all of us. So it's really nice. It's really great. Yeah. Thank you for doing. Yeah.
Oh, you're welcome. No, it's my pleasure. I get a lot out of it. I'm sure we'll be in touch. We're not a million miles away from each other, so I'm sure we'll be in touch. Probably on Skype though. But but for now, we'll say goodbye.
Fantastic. Thanks, John. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Bye.
Bye, John. Great to talk to you.
Remember to go to the Gently Does It Patreon page. Go to patreon.com/JohnDaltonGentlyDoesIt and join the conversation.
I've never felt this good in my entire life. Make me some spaghetti. Yeah, we are the Argyle Pimps. So buy us a drink. We're better than you thought, but not as good as we think. We are the Argyle Pimps. So buy us a drink. Come on.